matter of Garden State Check Cashing Service versus the Department of Banking and Insurance. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. For President Richie's son, Lawrence P. Warlock, Warlock Fund Vice President of the Chief.
Good morning, Your Honors. DAT, Darren Gonzalez, on behalf of the New Jersey Department of Banking and Insurance.
I am Greg Gonzalez, the Garden State Check Cashing Service.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Warlock, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve not more than 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case, notwithstanding the recitation in the appellate division opinion of the guiding principles and maxims of statutory construction, this case really involves the failure, as we see it, of the appellate division to follow those principles. And that failure in this case effectively causes the court to have misread and not properly set forth the legislature's intent. The maxims that should have been followed and were not in this case include the following. If words are susceptible to more than one possible meaning or interpretation, the court should not hesitate to look to secondary sources. When a dispute rests on multiple parts of a single statute, the court must strain to read and understand all of the provisions in harmony, and that's otherwise called reading the statute as a whole. The court should be careful in reading the language of the statute to distinguish between the use of words which are descriptive or definitional in nature and those which are substantive. And finally, the court should avoid an interpretation of the statute which leads to unreasonable, if not absurd, results. Finally, and this is not a principle of statutory construction, but rather of appellate review in this court, if the statutory language permits it, the court should afford great deference to the interpretation given to that statute by the agency, and in this case it's the Department of Banking and Insurance, and should reflect or reject that interpretation only if the department's view is totally unsupported by the evidence or is arbitrary and capricious. In this case, as we see it, all of these maxims have not been followed, and the standard of review, although expressed in the opinion, was also not followed. This case involves the 1993 Check Cashers Act, and the section is NJSA 17:15A-30. I will refer only to the particular subsection. And a history of how this statute evolved is critical to deciding this case and pinpointing the error that was made by the appellate division. In section 50A, I'll call it subsection 50A of the statute, the legislature specifically grandfathered existing businesses that were engaged in check cashing, describing them as any person holding a license in good standing pursuant to the previous law, which was the 1951 statute. And all that an existing licensee had to do was to submit certain written information to the commissioner upon which it would be considered a valid licensee under the new statute, the 93 statute. And since the new statute, the 93 statute, did insert for the first time what I'll call the distance requirement, the 2,500 foot provision, which I'll come to in a minute. This grandfather clause, Section 50A, said that upon qualifying as a licensee, the so-called grandfather, previous licensee, shall not be required to comply with that 2,500-foot distance requirement and also with certain other requirements that were now being inserted into the statute, but which are not relevant in this case. And in the new statute, as I said, the legislature did impose the 2,500-foot requirement upon new licensees, those who were not grandfathered, and that appears in Section 41E, no office or mobile office shall be located within 2,500 feet of an existing office or mobile office, with other language dealing with the measurement of that distance. It's clear from the legislative history that the legislature intended to protect and to preserve these grandfathered entities and to support them to the extent set forth.
Could you
address, please, the argument of your adversary that the check cashing business should have been actively engaged in the business at the time of the sale?
Yes. That is something that nowhere appears in the statutory language except by what we say is a very strained and you could either call it an expansive or a very narrow reading of the language in Section 32.1, which I was coming to, but I'll get to it now. That section basically says, literally says, a person who is conducting business as a check casher, pursuant to the old law, whose license was continued pursuant to the grandfather law, which is Section 15, and shall be entitled to sell the assets of the business if they satisfy three requirements. One, they, the seller, at the time, is not the subject of any action by the commissioner under the commissioner's regulatory powers. Number two, the purchaser qualifies for a license. And number three, the business will remain at the same physical location that it was before the purchase.
So if you could help us by focusing on the language of the introductory clause, conducting business as a check casher, tell us what you think it means, whether you think it's ambiguous, and if so, how we should interpret it based on the legislative history.
The phrase conducting business as a check casher is simply a shorthand way or a descriptive way of describing someone who is in the check cashing business whose license was continued. It's the way of identifying somebody who is grandfathered and someone whose license was continued and who is licensed.
Is a lawyer whose license is, continues to be licensed but who it moves to some nice warm spot and is no longer practicing, conducting business?
Well, if a lawyer is no longer practicing, that doesn't mean the lawyer can't return.
No, I understand that, but for
but
purposes
a lawyer
of
can be a lawyer can be no longer practicing and still remain licensed.
Is
right.
Conducting business with
is that lawyer conducting a law practice in New Jersey?
If the lawyer is not conducting a law practice at the time, then obviously the lawyer is not active. And in this case, we're not claiming that the seller had his doors open every day. And that's really the crux of what the appellate division is trying to say here, that they are imposing, through their interpretation of this language in Section 32.1, a requirement that the seller, even though it continues to be licensed, has to keep its doors open every day.
Let's say Rapid had, just hypothetically, I know it's not your facts, but let's say Rapid had shut down, the landlord rented the space out to somebody else, and there was no place in New Jersey where someone could go and get the services.
If Rapid was in the position where they no longer had control of the location and no longer was licensed to operate as a check cashier.
I'm not saying they didn't lose their license, but let's say the location, the landlord didn't renew, there's no location where you can go and access the services.
If there's no location, then the statute hasn't been complied with, because one of the terms of Section 32.1 is that the business continues at the same location or address from which it previously was being conducted by the seller of the business. And the problem, Your Honor, is when you get to look at how Section 32.1 came into play here, it came in 1998, 5 years after the original statute whose provisions I was talking about earlier. And it's clear, it seems to me, from the legislative history that the goal of that amendment was to, I'll say, equalize or almost equalize grandfathered businesses in the check cashing, grandfathered licensees, so that they could sell the assets of their business and the buyer, the first buyer and indeed subsequent buyers, if there were subsequent sales, would still have the benefits of being exempt from the 2,500-foot provision, which, if that applied, would put the licensee of that location out of business, because they'd then be within 2,500 feet of a competitor.
It would also make their assets suddenly worthless, because they would not be able to sell.
It would protect the value of the asset. Mm-hmm. It would also indirectly protect the public, because one of the purposes of grandfathering and protecting those who are grandfathered is to protect the public interest. Indeed, the whole 2,500-foot provision, as Your Honors may be aware, was subject to some very focused litigation in the Roman case, which is the only case that I'm aware of that dealt with this statute, and it was a very controversial provision, but it was upheld, its constitutionality was upheld, and this 1998 amendment was designed to put grandfathered licensees on the same platform as those who got their license after 1998, after 1993.
This requirement that the appellate division write in to have the doors open, if you will, on the business in order for it to qualify to be able to be transferred as a sale of assets is not consistent with the agency's interpretation. Is that correct?
It's not consistent with that. It's not consistent with or mentioned in any legislative history, and more to the point, as we have pointed out, and admittedly it was several years later, but it's part of the statutory scheme now, in 2003, Section 40D was added to the legislation, and that deals specifically with the subject that the appellate division mentioned and based its opinion on regarding this particular license. And that provision deals with what happens if a licensee does not keep his doors open while remaining a licensed check cashier.
And your argument is the legislature knew how to use that language when it wanted to, and it didn't use it in 32.1A.
It didn't do it in 32.1A, and to the extent it dealt with the subject of when you have to keep your doors open in order to keep your license, it defined what that was. And it defined it in a way that allowed for a period of time for a licensee to not keep its doors open and still be able, after 180 days at the discretion of the commissioner, to continue with its license or to lose its grandfather provisions. Mm-hmm. And this is not a case in which, it's a case in which the appellate division's interpretation seems to come out of the blue, although I understand it's one possible interpretation of that language. But it's not a subject on which the legislature was totally silent, as shown by Section 40D. So, that being so, and keeping in mind that it's the license and the location that governs, as we argue it, and as I believe the department has interpreted the statute in administering it throughout, that is what should govern here. And the appellate division interpretation should be rejected. It failed to consider the statute as a whole. It failed to fully recognize the overall intention to protect and preserve grandfathered enterprises. It makes, in fact, an illogical and unsupported distinction between grandfathered sellers of assets, who, according to this ruling, can't close their doors, even though they're still licensed, and still complete their sale, and those licensees who are not grandfathered, who presumably can close their doors, and as long as they still have a license, they can sell to a buyer who qualifies otherwise under the statute.
So what does conducting business mean? Give us a definition of what
conducting business
under the statute.
Conducting business in conjunction with the other language simply means you have a license to conduct business. It's simply in that particular sentence in the statute. It's a way of describing someone who is in the business as a licensed check casher, and nothing more and nothing less. And it does not deal with whether or not on the day that that party sells their assets, they have their doors open.
What is it the statute say? What you suggest? Someone who has an active license, as opposed to conducted business, it would have been much easier. That's your definition. That's not what's in the statute, is it? Your definition of it is what it means is someone who has an active license and could conduct business if they so desired. That's not what the statute says.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that is. That's not what that specific part of the language says. I agree with that. That's not what the whole statutory scheme says. When the grandfather provision came in, it simply described someone who was someone holding a license in good standing and who wished to continue to engage in the business. And even the section that we're talking about, 32.1, while it does talk about someone who is conducting business, it says whose license was continued. So it's someone who is a continuing licensee.
And now, is conducting business.
It doesn't say and, Your Honor, I don't want to mince words with the court, but it just says a person who's conducting business whose license was continued.
But read that as a conjunctive? I mean, there are
two
requirements?
I don't read it as conjunctive, but I also would say that whether you read it as conjunctive or not, the phrase a person who is conducting business is simply a way of identifying somebody who holds the license as a check casher whose license was continued.
You're conceding that the language is ambiguous. And what you're, tell me if I'm wrong, you're asking us now to give a sensible, plausible interpretation to those words.
Yeah, I could not stand here and say that it's not ambiguous to an extent. But I am saying further, Your Honor, that it's not definitional and substantive. It's just a, we can call it loose or generalized way of identifying someone who's a check casher. And that's the way it reads.
And has a business to sell. I mean, we can't ignore the language at the end of A. Shall be permitted to sell the assets of the business of checking, of cashing checks.
That's right.
So there is the notion of a business at that location properly licensed and somebody who is conducting check cashing.
And Your Honor,
these are all tied together, to some degree. It's not that, it's just not to the degree of the appellate division's requirement of daily operation on consecutive days for some length of time that came out of nowhere.
Agreed, Your Honor. And as I was saying a moment ago, If you took that interpretation of the language in 32.1 and said that anyone who has a grandfathered operation that wants to sell their assets has to remain open every day, they can't close for any reason, they can't close even because the new buyer wants to do renovations because they have to sign a new lease or whatever possible business or other reason they might have for closing, they can't close or else they've lost their license, whereas someone who is not grandfathered is not subject to this statute.
Mr. Arnold,
presumably a non-grandfathered licensee, anyone who became a licensee after 1993, can close for, no, I won't say as long as they want, but they can close without being subject to any other penalty for closing other than in Section 40D, the 180-day provision.
I think we have the gist of your argument. Is there anything you wanted to add before we bring you back?
The only other thing I want to say, Your Honor, is aside from having already told you that the department's interpretation and implementation of these laws is significant here, we have also asked the court, in the event, which I submit should be unlikely, that the court is otherwise impressed by the appellate division's interpretation of this provision, I would ask that you consider making the ruling prospective only. This is an interpretation that, and therefore allow, on equitable grounds, Rich, which has been in business for many, many years in this business, it's had this site now for something well over three, almost 4 years, you would allow them to continue under the prospective-only principle, which the court did put into effect in the Roman case. And we have a basis for it here because this is and would be new law. It's in, and it's, I would respectfully suggest, not something that one would notice at first blush. It's new law. It's different law.
But we
and our client equitably should be entitled to continue with the license he has, if the court buys the interpretation of the government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gazarian.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The Appellate Division interpreted NJSA 17:15A-32.1, the so-called asset sale amendment of the Check Cashers Regulatory Act, to require an active, continuous, uninterrupted operation of a grandfathered check cashing business in order to maintain the grandfather status and to transfer the status to subsequent operators of the business. This interpretation should be reversed because it was made in isolation from other statutory provisions and is too rigid, fundamentally unfair, and inconsistent with the overall statutory scheme. The plain meaning of the phrase, a person who is conducting business as a check casher pursuant to the Act, simply states that the provision at issue is addressed to check cashers under the Act. This interpretation is more flexible, fair, and consistent with the overall statutory scheme. The Appellate Division's rigid interpretation fails to recognize that the legislature intended to preserve the long-term value and viability of grandfathered check cashing businesses and not to create additional requirements for the maintenance of the grandfather status. In Section 40D, the legislature provided the department with the discretion to revoke a license for business inactivity. The legislature also acknowledged licensees' right to defend the property interest in their license and in the business to which the license attaches, consistent with constitutional due process. The Appellate Division's narrow interpretation fails to recognize that businesses often temporarily cease operation for a number of reasons. By ruling that a grandfathered status is lost immediately upon cessation of day-to-day operations, The appellate division restricted the department's regulatory power under Section 40D, and it created fundamental fairness and due process problems, because termination of a grandfather status can lead to a complete loss of the value of the business, which in some cases can be family's greatest monetary asset. If your honors have any questions, I'll be happy to answer the questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Sedini.
Thank you, your honors. We agree on one thing. This is a case of statutory construction. And it's always an issue when you go past the language of the statute, because legislative intent, let's face it, it's a murky issue, because there's no way to really know what 80, in our case, 80 assembly people, 40 senators, and the governor were thinking about when they enacted this. But looking at the language, and it is, to me, clear, is conducting business as a check casher, and Justice Albin, that to me is what is conducting business, but it's not just conducting business. It is conducting business as a check casher, which concededly Rapid was no longer doing as of October 21st, 2014, and that's right on the form. Now, it's interesting with the 180-day provision comes in. Once Rapid ceased doing business, under the department's own regulations, specifically Regulation 3:NJAC 3:5-4-4D, Rapid was obligated to turn that license in within 30 days. That's what they had to do. And the idea of rewarding someone for violating an obligation because I'm not sure what I want to do, that doesn't seem to be in accordance with the legislation. I think the bigger issue, to me at least, and what's been interesting here is, and it's laid out in the briefs, is the purpose of the 1998 amendment. Let's go back to 1993. There was no ability for someone in Rapid shoes to even sell the assets and preserve a location. They would have been required to sell a controlling interest in the business. And in that case, they would have been subject to, it wasn't just you can just do it. The commissioner would have been obligated to investigate and make a finding that at the time of that sale, the seller was not subject to getting revoked. Now it comes out, well, maybe we should do something for just asset sales. There's lots of reasons to have an asset sale. You want to skip liabilities necessarily of the predecessor. But under the interpretation of the Department of Banking and the petitioner, the commissioner has no obligation to look at the status of the seller at the time and make a determination as to the seller that they're not subject to revocation. It's a dichotomy that shouldn't exist. Why in one scenario would you have this investigation? Say, what's happened to you? Are you under arrest for anything? Or have you been arrested? What's going on here? And in the other scenario, nothing. That doesn't make sense. And that, to me, is not in accordance with the legislative intent. In point two of our appeal brief, I go through where it could be interpreted that the commissioner had to make those findings. But why is the, if you interpret the is conducting business as a check casher, who am I to say that the legislature, or anybody, to say the legislature didn't look at that as a shorthand method? If they're not conducting business as a check casher, okay, you're gone. And this idea of this preservation, no one has a right to be a check casher. You don't own the license. The statute's pretty clear that the license belongs to the state, and it's not transferable. without permission. It's not an ownership interest. It's a privilege. And it's not transferable or assignable. 15A32 is pretty clear on that. So you hold this at the goodwill of the state, so to speak. And if you don't comply with the act, you don't get to keep it. And here with the grandfathered clause, the whole idea of the 2,500 foot was, I guess it'd be more like, it's like franchising. You don't want too many McDonald's too close because then the business can't survive. So there were concessions made at the time. We'll do this. And then I think justifiably so, what do you do with locations that already exist that are within 2,500 feet? You can't pick one or the other. So you do have a grandfathering.
So this comes down to the meaning of the first phrase in 32.1A.
I think that's the primary thing, Your Honor.
And you've given us a reasonable interpretation of what conducting business as a check cashier is. Your read of it is that you have to actively be engaged in the business. You have to be cashing checks for customers.
In order to avail yourself of that, yes.
Another reasonable interpretation is that you need to be in the business of serving as a check cashier. Why is that not reasonable?
I don't think, the way Your Honor phrased that, I don't think those two things are different. But is conducting business as a check cashier in order to avail yourself? That's what it says. I don't think that's subject to interpretation. And so, I think even if you get past that and they find some ambiguity, I think the legislative history supports our client's interpretation.
So the literal reading that you're suggesting means that if the owner suffers a death or a loss or a health ailment and has to shut down for 2 weeks, they can't sell that business?
They can't sell the assets and preserve the location. If it's 2 weeks, that's a different animal than we have here.
Why? Are they actively conducting business as a check cashier if they have to shut the business down for a
They've
family emergency?
They've got 30 days.
Let me finish the question. Let me finish the question.
Okay, sorry, Your Honor.
If they need to shut the business for a 2-week period for emergency health reasons, they're not actively conducting business as a check cashier in the way that you've described it.
That is true.
So if they go on vacation for a couple of weeks and shut the business because they want to share that with all of the trusted employees and not leave the business open, they're no longer able to sell the assets of the business?
How does that make sense? I think it gets down to an issue of ceasing operating. A temporary cessation.
You get that from where?
The cessation actually comes from the department's form that they fill out.
Are you reading that into the phrase conducting business as a check cashier?
Is conducting business as a check cashier. I read that when you cease operating, not necessarily temporary, did something, but you've ceased operating. I think that runs afoul of the statute.
So that, too, may be a reasonable interpretation, but aren't you inserting words that aren't there to add clarity to something that is not quite so clear on its face?
I don't think we're inserting. I think those words are consistent with is conducting business as a check cashier. You go on vacation. You haven't ceased to conduct business as a check cashier.
But you can go, look, you could, 2-week vacation, how about a 12-week, 16-week family leave, or 6 months to care for an ailing parent? Would you say that person is no longer conducting business, can't sell the assets?
I would, Your Honor, in the sense that if that's a situation, you've got to go and get permission from the Department of Banking, which was not done. That provision in 40D presumes you're going to go to the Department of Banking, and you're going to get that permission. And that wasn't done here.
Then why do we have the statute allowing the department, after 180 days, from taking the license? Why can't they just do it whenever it appears that they're suspended for any substantial period of time? In other words, what does that 180 days mean, and what does that statute mean?
I think it goes to the area where someone's voluntarily ceasing a temporary thing. But I agree, Your Honor. The department come in and take this license anytime it wants.
But it's a permissive statute. It says that the department may come in and give notice to the licensee and revoke the license for good cause shown. It's permissive. They don't have to do it.
That is true.
We're in the statute. This is say that if a person is going on a family leave for 6 months to care for an ailing parent, that person has to get permission from the Department of Banking and Insurance.
It doesn't say that, Your Honor. That's the interpretation. If someone's asking me the hypothetical, under a certain circumstance, I'm shutting down this business for a period of time.
Interpretation of what? I'm looking at the statute. What statute would you be interpreting?
I wouldn't interpret it that way. It says it's conducting business.
D? You said you have to get the permission.
Well, 40D talks about this 180-day provision. And
I just don't see where in the statutory structure, if someone is going on leave for a period of time or even extended period of time, they have to get the permission of Department of Banking Insurance. Now, on the other hand, under D, they may, if it's more than 6 months, they may be running into some trouble, but that's a different issue. No?
With the regulation itself, if I cease operating business, I have to turn my license in 30 days. I have to.
Mr. Cedini, talk to us about Dobie's position, because they've come into the case and they have an interpretation that differs from yours. What deference are they due?
As far as interpreting the law, Your Honor, I don't see any regulatory agency having a superior right to the court as opposed to interpreting the statute. I don't see that.
So no deference to an area of law that is within their expertise and their regulatory responsibility?
I don't see that. I think it abdicates position of it creates a regulatory body that's becoming an overlord of the legislature and the courts. I think it's for this court to interpret statutes. I think it could be guidance. I think, as with any source, but to bind this court or any court, I don't see that. I don't think that's appropriate.
No one would suggest it's binding, but if it's a close call between two plausible interpretations, and the agency that has responsible for enforcing this regulatory scheme, could that push the needle against you?
That would be up to you, Your Honor. if it's persuasive to Your Honors, yes. But I wouldn't say it's deference. It has to be persuasive to the court, because it's ultimately, I don't think the court should hide behind its deference here. We don't have to think about it. I think the court has to think about it. It may be persuasive authority to the court because it may persuade the court that this is appropriate. And that I understand. And I don't
In which situations do you think we should give deference to an agency such as this? And I'm not talking about just Dobie, but say the Division of Motor Vehicles, anyone. When would we ever, under your interpretation, give deference to their expertise?
I think it would be more appropriate when they make findings of fact in connection with an issue that came up.
Why would we get deference to the findings of fact as opposed to their interpretation of the law that they're being created to enforce?
I think that's consistent.
Why their facts?
I think that's consistent with how the court defers to a trial court. It's findings of fact versus interpretation of the law.
But if they had passed a regulation and it was a reasonable interpretation of the statute that they're charged with enforcing, we would defer to that, would we not?
Not if it's inconsistent with the statute
itself. If it's a reasonable interpretation of the statute, don't we defer?
That, again, is up to the court. I don't think you're bound, but I think it's something, if it's persuasive. I hesitate to use the word deference as opposed to we're persuaded by the position of the department.
I'm just hearkening back to a standard of review in the context of administrative regulations.
Administrative regulations, I think there's a danger that courts abdicate their responsibility by going with deference too much. And it's a danger to me. That's my position on it. It doesn't mean that they're to be ignored. That's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that it's really up to the court. And as a means of, when it comes to interpreting a statute, that is ultimately for the court to decide. But Your Honor, I just want to address the issue of a prospective application, which, if Your Honor is inclined to affirm, I don't think this is the case for prospective application.
You want to get the benefit of carrying the water.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You want to get the benefit if
well,
you
that,
win.
That for sure. But I want to address the arguments made in support of it.
Right.
The petitioner here had no vested interest in this location. Perhaps Rapid might have had some interest and could continue that interest provided it complies with everything else under the statutes. They took a shot, much like a buyer at a foreclosure sale. Okay, I might go here, but I got to do my due diligence, and I may be subject to everything else that occurs with that. And I think what's important to look at here is the asset purchase agreement itself. They knew there was a risk here. It's in the record at page 274. It's the asset purchase agreement. Notably, the purchase price was based on 50% of check cashing fees from the other two locations, not any fees from Rapid. So it seems to me Rapid was like, hey, I don't know if this is going to survive, and I want to make sure I get paid. We're not basing this purchase price on anything from Rapid, because if that gets shut down, I'm not getting the money I expected. So they thought about it, and I think was part of their agreement. At the time, they were fully aware of the challenge by my client. They chose to go forward. I don't blame them for that. They have differing positions, but it's not as if something snuck up on them. And they've been able to stay in business for coming up 4 years now. They've profited. So I don't think there's any horrible harm, and I don't think the sky will fall in the check cashing industry to deny prospective application. People will know what they're doing. It's a unique circumstance. I don't think there's many people who get affected by it. But unless Your Honors have other questions, I've said my piece.
You know, I have one more. It doesn't deal directly with the statute. I don't know if you've noticed, as I have, that the wind seems to be louder. When Justice Fernandez Vina was asking questions, and do you have a theory why that is?
Because
like
God is on my side.
Yeah, and you're hearing it outside.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr.
Thank Rodon, you, Your Honor.
Did you want to offer a rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
Careful, the wind's blowing.
It's pure speculation, this argument as to who took the risk and what the terms of the agreement was. There's nothing in the record that supports the speculation that counsel's engaged in. This was a negotiated transaction, and indeed, my client did take on obligations to pay rent and back rent on this Irvington location. So the idea that he just was paying nothing, he knew was taking a risk, is simply something not in the record at all. In terms of the prospective argument, and I'm going backwards now and responding to counsel, these two sites were there within 2,500 feet of each other for at least 25 to 30 years, because they're both there, grandfathered under the when the 1993 Act was passed. So we have an established setup of these two check cashing businesses that remained in business, and my client has picked it up and is serving the public admirably as far as anybody knows, and I'm sure he is. In terms of 40D, the 180-day provision, I just wanted to point out, since the court did ask about it, if you look at the legislative history, the original bill that was introduced
said that at the end of the 180 days, if there's been nothing, if nothing's happened, the license shall be revoked. That's been changed. That never passed. The existing legislation continues the non-operation until the commissioner decides whether to revoke, suspend, or extend the time. And in terms of the hypotheticals, picking up on Justice Albin's idea of a 2-week and a 12-week vacation, I would throw out another one. And this one is not something unreasonable or far out. Suppose the owner of the business passes away and now his estate is looking to sell, and they're not open while they're finding a buyer. They do have some time limits, but have they lost the total value of their asset because the estate cannot operate the business? That's just another for instance. Finally, and this is the first argument that counsel made when he got up, this whole idea of somehow doing an end run around the controlling interest provision of the statute, which is section 42, that argument was made to the appellate division, in this case, in connection with the other two sites where the appellate division affirmed the license. And the discussion is particularly on pages 16 to 18 of the slip opinion, and I would just direct the court to that as you determine this case. But clearly, the controlling interest provision is different. As the appellate division said, in the case of a controlling interest, the commissioner is interested in looking into the qualifications of the party who is acquiring the controlling interest, which, interestingly enough, in this statute is defined as 25% or more, a definition of controlling interest I've never encountered before, but that's what the statute says. And it's the applicant who wants to be included as part of the owner of the business that is being looked at, and the original owner presumably is still remaining as at least a non-controlling interest holder, and as the appellate division says, it's the applicant who the appellate division considers would be investigated. In the case of a sale of the assets of the business, the selling owner is disappearing from the scene, and the statute 32.1 provides for investigation and licensure, if they can obtain it, of the buyer of the assets. And that all makes sense logically. And I think that's all I have, unless the court has any questions in rebuttal to counsel.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess.